Good evening.
Good evening.
Open your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. In 1 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, Paul discusses things sacrificed to idols, and particularly with regard to the use of our liberties. And so that's what we're going to focus attention on this evening. But I want to begin by talking with you a little bit about the world's perception of power. The world operates from the standpoint, if I've got power and control, I use it for my own benefit and to demand my rights. In the scripture, the use of power is in the other direction. You use the power that you have to work to build up and to edify and to empower other people. You might not realize it, but when you think about the use of our liberties, indeed, it is involving a discussion underlying the use of power. And we're going to see that in the first few verses here as we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And when we think about the use of power in the world's perception and compare that with what the Lord does and what he has exemplified to us, there is a diametric difference. And in this context, what Paul is doing, in my judgment, is he's trying to teach the Corinthians how to use power in a good way. This is what he says. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. I want you to stop with me right there. What have we learned about power already? It can be destructive, yes. Our knowledge gives us a feeling of power, doesn't it? A feeling of control. And so he says knowledge makes arrogant. And when we have knowledge or we think that we have knowledge about something, we tend to exercise that knowledge to control the situation. And then his contrast with that is, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there's no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. Now you can kind of hear this difficulty unfolding in the congregation at Corinth. You might hear one individual say, well, I don't think it's right to eat meat sacrificed to idols. And another might respond and say something like, oh, an idol's nothing. Idols really do not exist except in these images. They're just images, that's all. There are no gods. So eating meat sacrificed to an idol is just like eating any other meat. It's all the same. Don't worry about it. But then the other person says, but this is communing with an idol. Now you say, well, it's not communing with an idol. Well, let me read with you over in chapter 10, in verses 14 and following. My beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men, you judge what I say. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there is one bread, and we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the same one bread. Look at the nation of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons, The idea here is that they sacrifice to no gods, literally. No gods. That's what idols are. No gods. Demons. And they don't sacrifice them to God. I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons, or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We're not stronger than He, are we? Okay, so whose argument do you agree with? The ones that says we are not supposed to be sharers in idols, or the one that says, well, the idol is nothing. You can eat meat sacrificed to an idol. Oh, they both have good points. That's the way it is, isn't it, when people generally disagree? They both have some good points. So, what are you going to do in this case? Well, if I... Go ahead. You're a sanctified people. You're the possession of God.
Exactly, because all the stuff we've been saying, like,
yes,
we really see. I mean, I guess that just kind of struck me as a, wow, we got to be really careful not to discount that side.
You are a separate people.
You can see why they would be separate.
Yes, you can see.
I don't know if you had mentioned this before, but is your understanding that the congregation here are predominantly made of Gentiles?
Well, there are Gentiles in the group, for sure. What did we learn when we studied the historical background to the book of 1 Corinthians? Yeah. Yeah, some are Gentiles, for sure. So what would that have to do with this?
Well, if the Gentiles, the Jews, even though they already have an understanding of God.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, they could go after other idols.
Mm-hmm.
But the Gentiles were steeped in idol worship.
Yes.
And it would have meant something to
yes.
the Gentiles. So it's a mixed group. Then you have the Jews who are basically saying, well, we know there is no God.
Okay.
And you have the Gentiles who
have in the past been idol worshipers.
Maybe not so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that this meat that is, for example, sold in the marketplace in a great likelihood could have been sacrificed to an idol and then sold. And you would be eating meat sacrificed to an idol. And so if they were accustomed to the idol until now, and now they have been converted to Christianity, then eating meat sacrificed to an idol would have been for them doing what? Sharing with the idol. Okay? Yes?
Are we still talking about the meat that's been sacrificed for religious feasts?
Yeah, it's the meat. It's the meat. Yeah, we're really not talking about entering into a special place or worship assembly of idol worshipers and eating the meat there. It's available everywhere. So it's a problem. It's a problem.
It's interesting that they're worshiping to their God, but they're taking it probably not.
That's not surprising for idol worshipers. That's what idol worshipers do. Okay? Yes. 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 He says it's interesting that they are worshiping their God with it and then they're taking it and selling it to people. I said that's what idol worshipers do. They profit from their situation. Okay. So yeah, I want you to kind of get a flavor for what the situation is here and the reconstruction based upon what this text here in 1 Corinthians is actually saying. Now, a lot of times what we do is we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and we say, oh, well, an idol is nothing, so it's no making a big deal. This is not a matter of grave significance to us. And besides that, I'm not an idol worshiper, and I don't know where I would get any meat sacrificed to an idol if I wanted to. So this is not a real issue. Yes. Okay. All right. So what you're saying is that even though this culture that we're living in right now may not have any temptation to eat at an idol's temple or have opportunity to even eat any kind of meat that would be sacrificed to idols, that that's not the case with all cultures. Okay. But our tendency is to discount it, right? Now, my next question is, how are you going to apply this? I think that the application is fairly obvious, that we need to give consideration to the conscience of our brother, and that we need to be sensitive to that other brother's conscience. And if this causes my brother's conscience to be violated, or it encourages him to sin, what should my response be? Not do it. Okay. Now my question is, are you ready to stop eating bacon? Somebody says, well, maybe bacon, but not country ham. Okay. Well, you get the idea here. You get the idea. And you think about what it would mean for you to never eat pork again or never eat any meat again. And you're beginning to get, shall we say, a flavor for what this context is suggesting. But Paul says, if it causes my brother offense, that is, it encourages him to violate his conscience, then I will never eat meat again. What that means is you don't get to do what you have the right to do. Well, now you're talking about the application and the design of when you're doing it. How would it be offensive to me to encourage me to violate my conscience if I didn't know you were doing it? Okay. Well, it couldn't unless you told me or somehow the other communicated to me that that's what you were doing. It might encourage me to do the same kind of thing. So if it's going to be private, then let it be private. Don't go around telling everybody, well, I'm doing this at home. And kind of, as my mother used to say, rubbing their nose in it. Because what this text is telling us is that we show respect to the other person's conscience, even though they may not have the right conclusion. So it is saying to us that we need to restrict our liberties when we cause someone else to stumble by doing what we believe that we have the right to do. Okay? Yes?
Sometimes we just want to teach them the right way.
Oh, yes.
Come on now.
Yes. With a finger on their forehead sometimes, we're trying to teach them the right way. I'm going to persuade you to my view, and therefore I'll get to do what I want to do. Well, now, here's my point relative to power. What are we doing? We're using our power to try to get what we want. We're attempting to dominate. And that's not what this text is saying. It runs completely counter to what this text is saying. What this text is saying is you use your power in a way that edifies. That's characteristic of love. Yes? Okay.
I've never run into, maybe at least
Okay? Okay. Yeah, we can tell you something a little bit later. Go ahead. On Sunday, you're saying, yeah.
Violated that, it was taboo.
It's
really changed in my lifetime.
Yes. So our culture has changed a little bit, probably not for good reason, but probably for covetous reasons it's changed. But okay, go ahead.
I don't know if this is answering John's question, but I was when you said, you know, are you willing to stop eating bacon? You know, I've never heard that as an actual example. You're right. Now that could be. I think of some stuff maybe that we've minimized a lot over the years, like practicing during Christmas.
Okay. Good.
That's one of those where it's kind of like, you know, if you over what I've experienced is, well, if you have a problem practicing Christmas, you just don't worry about it. Let us do what we want to do. That's kind of how I've seen it approach over here. I can see how, you know, some people that are close to Christians observing Christmas in any shape or form, they're kind of approaching this from this very, like, the associations with it I don't like. So I just, any religious associations with it, so because of that, I totally just want to not do anything like that. I guess that's one of those where I think those kind of folks are so often in the minority that we just end up.
Okay, I want to talk some more about this one.
The first thing I thought of when John was questioning, my grandparents were opposed to dice and cards.
Because it represented gambling. Okay. Let's think about Christmas now here for a moment. In this country, we say, well, it's just a secular holiday, right? Go to Colombia, where the predominant religion is Roman Catholicism and where the majority of Christians come out of a Roman Catholic background. So, when Christmas comes around, what's their feeling? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And guess what? They don't do it. Are you with me? You understand why? See, like these that may have come from idol worship backgrounds, now they are Christians, it's hard for them to meld this together. And they would be very well schooled in making the argument, well, this would be sharing in the idols, because that's what we always did. We shared in the idol. We worshiped the idol by eating this meat. We were associating ourselves with idol worship. Therefore, we can't do that. And the same thing is characteristic of the Christians in Colombia relative to Christmas. Also.
And they use the phrase idolatry. I think I heard that when I was down.
You will. You will.
Idolatry.
Yes.
It is very similar.
Yes. Now, there is another practice here in this country that is very well known, and you all probably do it. We have a holiday end of October called Halloween. Okay? And we think, well, we understand, you know, this may come out of a background and a history with decorating one's face and pretending to be a demon and all that kind of thing, but we know that demons don't really exist and this is all just pretend. Transfer over to Colombia. And they ask you, do you observe Halloween? And you say, well, yeah, we have a little party, you know, and give away candy and put on what my parents used to say, false faces and that kind of thing. Sometimes I'm afraid that the masks that we put on are hiding our false faces. But be that as it may, you're trying to convince them that this is something that you are legitimately practicing and it's okay for Christians to do this. And then their response is, Well, here in Colombia, it is associated with devil worship. And what happens here in Colombia in this period of time where people are dressing like this is that they are abducting kids and mutilating and destroying them. And you go, my giving away candy doesn't need to imply anything like that. It's not meant to imply anything like that. But you see why they would say, well, we don't celebrate that day here. You understand why? Yes? Okay, so again, we're talking about how we use power here. It may be an area of liberty, but we are not privileged to use our power to force the other person to be encouraged or to violate their conscience. Now, having said that, I want to back up and flip this over and look at the other side of it for a moment. And this is what I have experienced among people in some instances. Well, you're being offensive to me, and therefore this passage tells you that you're not supposed to offend me. And I don't like it when you do this or that. Is that... Some of you are shaking your head. Sue? That's right. But this person says, but I don't like it. And this passage says, what's he trying to do relative to his power? He's trying to do the same thing. And sometimes what we do is we allow that person to do that. Yes?
I've actually been in that situation.
Mm. Okay. And even in that kind of a situation, we have to be careful that we're not attempting to do this number again. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that you are, and I know that you're not trying to do that. But even in that situation, we've got to be careful that we're not doing this number to each other. Because that's not the correct use of power in the biblical context. Power, in the biblical context, lifts the other person up. Love edifies, as he says. Phyllis and David.
I understand that Matthew still has a problem with the fact that they just couldn't conscientiously do whatever it is, then they should not do it.
Okay. And we need to encourage them not to violate their conscience. Okay? Yes?
It seems there's a fine line of judgment of when to apply, not to apply, and there's a lot to weigh as far as whether... To let them have their way, is that empowering them when they're actually have a lack of knowledge of what the Bible teaches, or is it? You see what I'm saying?
Well,
when to give in and when not.
Yeah. Here's my response to that: it's not a matter of letting them have their way. Right. You know, the way that we perceive this, it's not about them having their way and us or me not getting mine. Because when we're using that kind of language, we're revealing that our perspective is the worldly perspective. The question is, what is going to be edifying here? What's going to be the best thing for the communication of the message of the gospel? What's going to be the best thing here for the advantage of the kingdom? You see? Yes.
For instance, the meeting
churches just have one cup.
Right.
And when they realize, well, you know, it's not actually required, and we understand the principle, but yet there would be some that it would offend them to go to plural cups. And so you know, to say, well, I don't want them to have to drink out of multiple cups if it causes them to sin, so I'm going to go ahead, even though I know it's proper, obviously, in the New Testament church, they didn't have one cup for all Christians. They certainly had, even when Paul said, talked about the cup we share, obviously he was writing to a different city, and they didn't share the same cup. Mm-hmm. And so, you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
When we come back to it, it's not really my power versus their power, but what edifies the church and what is difficult for the church.
Exactly.
It may cause this person to have difficulty, but if we cater to them, we allow them to continue in their error, and it's difficult for the whole church.
Uh-huh. So the question is, what is going to contribute to the well-being of the gospel?
Yeah.
What is going to edify here? Yes, Steve.
I'm just thinking, acting out of love.
Mm-hmm.
Your consideration for, you can love that person that may not agree with you,
mm-hmm.
that you can't really change everything to help them, but I think of communication.
Mm-hmm.
You have to,
mm-hmm.
to talk with the people and just not snub up and you go your way and I'll go mine and we'll both be happy Christians.
But when it's about the power thing, me versus you, that's exactly what happens. See, instead of what is beneficial to the cause of Christ, it's about me and you. And then we get angry with each other, and as you put it, snub up, and we're taking an adversarial stance now, and that is not conducive to what's best for the gospel, because we've already talked about in this text unity. That is running counter to the unity that Christ died to procure. And so we need to think about the use of power. We need to think about how we're going to use it so that it is edifying to the other person and not just advancing our own personal cause. Now, having said that, I want you to look with me just a moment at chapter 9. Paul continues this same frame of reference. He says, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? Now, if he were to stop right there, he would have good reason to stand on top of the pile and say, don't you guys understand? You owe me here. He says, if to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. Don't you recognize that I'm the one that brought you the gospel in the first place? Don't you recognize that God has separated me apart as an apostle? So I could speak to you from an authoritative position, or an authoritarian position for that matter. He says, my defense to those who examine me is this, do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? Well, what's his point? I have a right, but I'm not going to. Did you get it? I have a right, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to use my rights. Why not? If it doesn't edify, I'm not going to use my rights. What I'm going to do is I'm going to act in a way that builds up, that encourages, that edifies, rather than demanding my rights. Now, our country, our society is all big about me having my rights. Right? And we demand it. It's my right to do this. Okay? What you're thinking is, I'm in this powerful position and I've got a right to do it and therefore I'm going to. And who are you going to ride over roughshod in order to do that? Well, somebody says, well, I'll ride over anybody that I want. Now you see what the world's perspective is. Oh, it does, doesn't it?
Isn't that interesting? Well, the law is a very powerful force, isn't it?
Better to be wronged.
Why? You're going to law before unbelievers. Here are these two Christians, and one's trying to defraud the other, and you're going to law with each other and before unbelievers. How does that benefit the message of the gospel? It defeats you. Okay? Well, it goes on to talk about this more. I'm not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? It is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is thrashing. Now, who has power over the ox? The owner does. What is a muzzle? It's an object of controlling and exercising power over this ox. So you see, and the point is, you don't muzzle the ox while he's thrashing. You don't use that kind of power on this ox. He says God's not concerned about oxen, is he? Well, is he? Yes, he's concerned about oxen too. But the point is, if he's concerned about oxen, he's especially concerned about you. He's speaking, or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thrasher to thrash in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, now here's the application, if we sowed spiritual things in you, another way of saying that, if we taught you about the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If we gain money and blessings from you? If others share the right over you, do not we more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things so that we will cause, here it is, no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share from the altar? So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. Okay. So Paul is saying here, he is not using his right. What is his right? To get his living from the gospel. But he's not using that. Why? He's doing what will be beneficial to these Christians. Now, we know that he took income from congregations to preach. Philippians chapter 1 and chapter 4. We know he did that. He talked about how that he robbed other churches to make the gospel available to others. So he sometimes did use the right. Sometimes he made tents to provide for himself, didn't he? Okay? I want you to see this now. Even though he has a right, he doesn't demand it. Yes.
David, in the Philippian letter, he talks about it being a gift.
Yes.
Not a payment or a reward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, notice what he's saying. Not a payment. Did you hear that? Not a wage, but a gift. That's interesting. Oh, so we're going to use our power in a way that edifies. Our financial power, we're going to use it in a way that is beneficial for the spread of the gospel. Now, let me say something about this. There are some who would want to negotiate more preaching for less money. Have you ever seen anything like that? Don't answer out loud. As if what they wanted to do is to negotiate some kind of bargain. If I'm understanding this text correctly here, that approach is inappropriate. On the other side of the issue, some may be found to be preaching motivated by a desire for more. That's not appropriate either. It would seem to me that both involve inappropriate and self-centered uses of power. It is not the business of the teacher, nor the business of those that are taught to be self-centered. Now, when you go somewhere to get a job out in the world, what happens? This is a negotiation. How much work can I get out of you for how little money? Right? That's the way the world operates. Is that the way the people of God are supposed to operate in light of the fact that they're supposed to be working on the same page here to produce good things relative to the gospel? It's the opposite. Yes, we're in this together, folks. It's not preachers against congregations and congregations against preachers and this brother over here against this sister over here and that kind of thing, because all of that runs counter to everything that 1 Corinthians has been saying up to this point. You should.
And kind of goes back to our giving.
Just giving.
Giving yourself to the Lord. You can give to each other on whatever level you can, but I don't know, it just seems like if you, I don't like how it sounds, but putting your money where your mouth is.
Yes. I need to put my money where my heart is. And the fact of the matter is, I will. The real question is, where is my heart? And it's going to show up.
It seems like when we're demanding our rights, it's like we're just taking terms, taking from one another.
Mm-hmm.
I need this, I want this.
Yes, yes.
It turns the other way, but when we're doing the opposite, when we're giving, when I'm giving to you, you're giving to me, we're all back and forth giving, it's like everything's overflowing with, we have way more than we could ever get by demanding.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? It seems that we have more than we could ever bargain for. Okay. Now, our emphasis is on what is beneficial to the cause of Christ. In this text here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul says, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win some or win the more. Here's the bottom line. Each of us needs to make ourselves slaves so that we win others. Somebody said, well, I don't want to be a slave. I have a right to be free. Well, yeah, you do. You really do. So, if you're free, then you can be a slave. Without complaint. We need more slaves in the pulpit. We need more slaves in the pew, and we need more slaves everywhere. People that are slaves to Christ, slaves to this message, slaves to communicate that message, and they're willing to subject themselves to what they regard as the one most important thing. And so we need teachers and we need learners who are willing to make sacrifices. Being willing to make sacrifices for the sake of the gospel. That's one of the principles that's underlying this text. Is it not? Restrict your liberty make a sacrifice for the cause of Christ. Thank you for your attention.